Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Operation Sea Lion, Hitler's Invasion Plan for Britain, by David Ragg, narrated by Chris McDonnell. Introduction. The British Isles had not been invaded since 1066, but in the summer of 1940, Nazi Germany seemed unstoppable. The German army and air force had swept through Poland, paused for the winter, and then invaded Denmark and Norway, in the latter case landing from the sea and the air, before turning their attention to Belgium, the Netherlands, and then France. Even before the Second World War had started, Germany had annexed Austria and taken Czechoslovakia. Hitler had secured his eastern flank through an alliance with the Soviet Union that not only provided security, but fuel, food, and raw materials, so that a British blockade would not have the same devastating effects that Germany had experienced during the First World War. Germany, after all, had far more modern means at its disposal for an invasion than had William of Normandy in 1066. The Mediterranean was closed to merchant shipping, other than in convoy, and the Suez Canal then became part of a roundabout route from the UK to Egypt and Cyprus via the Cape of Good Hope, the Indian Ocean, and the Red Sea. In the Mediterranean and North Africa, Italy's belated entry into the war as an ally of Germany threatened the British colony and base of Malta and the Suez Canal, the vital link to the Persian Gulf, as it was then known, and India, Australia, and the Far East. As the British adjusted to this new state of affairs, realizing that they were on their own, and being thankful that at least most of the personnel of the British Expeditionary Force had been recovered, albeit without their transport and heavy equipment, a new threat emerged. Invasion. Aerial reconnaissance discovered invasion barges being gathered in the French and Belgian Channel ports. While the RAF bombed the barges, efforts were made to improve the equipment of the Irish Free States armed forces, in case a German invasion came via Ireland, thinly populated and weakly defended. These were the preparations for the invasion of England, a plan known to the Germans as Seeluwe, Sea Lion. Just how realistic was the German threat of invasion? Chapter 1. The Unstoppable Hun. On the night of 15-16 September 1940, Guy Gibson, later to be the most famous of the Royal Air Force's bomber pilots, was flying a Handley Page Hampden bomber over the port of Antwerp in German-occupied Belgium. It was the biggest raid on the port at that early stage of the war. It was the night of the full moon. Many barges were sunk, many blew up, destroying others around them, recalled Gibson. They were full of stuff, and we could see, there and then, there was no doubt about it. The Germans were ready. Flying low over the docks that night, we could easily see the tanks on board, the guns on mountings at the stern of each invasion craft, the tarpaulins over sinister objects on the docks. Der Tag was drawing near for the Hun, and September 15th was, perhaps, the day when they realized that it would be no use. What had brought the RAF to bomb barges in a Belgian port? Indeed, why were barges being gathered in northern France and Belgium? France had fallen on 21 June, less than 6 weeks after the German invasion had begun after nightfall on 12 May. The evacuation of the British Army, as well as many French soldiers, from Dunkirk had been completed on 3 June, leaving most of their equipment behind them. France and the United Kingdom had declared war on Germany on 3 September 1939, after Germany had ignored an Anglo-French ultimatum for Germany to withdraw from Poland, which had been invaded 2 days earlier. It seems that the Germans did not expect the United Kingdom and France to act upon their ultimatum. Indeed, both the head of the German Navy, or Kriegsmarine, Erich Raeder, and his U-boat commander and eventual successor, Karl Dönitz, were taken by surprise and had to temporarily excuse themselves from meetings when the news was passed to them. After all, there had been no Anglo-French intervention during the Sudetenland crisis almost a year earlier, and a look at a map showed that neither of the two allies was well placed to intervene in Poland, with Germany, the most populous and largest country in Western Europe, sitting firmly between France and Poland, and able to control the natural approaches to the Baltic, the Skagerrak, and Kattegat. It was not just this, for during the intervening period, Germany had completed the occupation of Czechoslovakia with little fuss. Germany had earlier, in March 1938, absorbed Austria into the Third Reich, but not without the support of many of that country's population. Germany and what had been at the time the Austro-Hungarian Empire had been allies in the First World War. Post-war, plans to call Austria Deutsch-Österreichische were banned by the Allied Control Commission, determined not to see the creation of what might be called a Greater Germany from the ruins of what had been the costliest and bloodiest war in history. Nevertheless, the dream of a united German people lived on, with many yearning for an Anschluss, or joining together, of the two countries. Germany's ally, Italy, had also been expanding across the Adriatic into the Balkans, and more controversially, had nearly started a European war with its invasion of Abyssinia, present-day Ethiopia, in October 1935. The British and French government's policy of appeasement had been highly acceptable for most of the British population. In 1939, Mass Observation, the official public opinion polling organisation, had found most people were keen to avoid war at almost any price, with memories of the First World War still vivid. In Germany, the invasion of Poland was supported by many as simply being a case of Germany regaining territory lost in the First World War, when Poland's boundaries had been extended westwards by the Treaty of Versailles. Germany did not complete the occupation of Poland until the launch of Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of the Soviet Union, in summer 1941. And in the meantime was content to allow the Soviet Union to occupy the eastern area of the country. Trade between the Soviet Union and Germany continued right up to the start of the invasion, as Germany was heavily reliant on Soviet supplies of food, raw materials, and, most important of all, oil. The traffic was not one way, as the Soviet Union also needed German machinery and vehicles. While much attention has rightly been given to Hitler's demands for Lebensraum, living space, for Germany's population, the other important factor was that Germany was heavily dependent on imports, with few natural resources other than coal. Even agriculture was only viable with massive imports of fertilizer. Poland was invaded on the pretext of what might be described as a frontier provocation. But Poland was in no state to invade Germany. In 1939, the country was one of the most backward in Europe, with poor roads and communications, less than 100,000 lorries, and the armed forces were using obsolete equipment. The Poles fought valiantly, but were overwhelmed by strong Germany forces. It should not be assumed that the Germans were completely superior to the other countries in Europe, or their armed forces. There were serious weaknesses in the German armed forces. The Air Force, the Luftwaffe, was the best equipped and had been the favoured service since the Nazi takeover. Yet even the Luftwaffe lacked heavy bombers with long range and had developed as a force to operate in close coordination with fast-moving ground forces, with assaults spearheaded by armoured formations. And this combination of close air support and tanks, the famous panzers, was the basis of the concept of Blitzkrieg, lightning war. The Luftwaffe also lacked transport aircraft to compare with the American Douglas C-47 Dakota, or Skytrain, the military development of the DC-3 airliner. The German Junkers Ju-52 was an older, slower, and less capable design, originally designated as a bomber transport, but obsolete as a bomber during the Spanish Civil War and as a transport by 1939. No less important, the absence of full-time transport squadrons and aircrew meant that the bomber training schools were raided for pilots when an airborne assault was required, interrupting training of bomber pilots while their instructors were away. The German Army, or Heer, had fast-moving panzer units, but the supply units had not been mechanized between the wars, unlike those of the British Army, and so there was an almost complete dependence on horses to pull supply wagons and field artillery. This meant that the German advances were held up by the slower pace of the horses, with the tank units risking becoming isolated from infantry and artillery, while the supply of fodder for the horses was an added burden, being bulky and much more difficult to transport than fuel, and of course, much more of it was needed. The German Navy, or Kriegsmarine, War Navy, after a change ordered by Adolf Hitler from the post-Great War Reichsmarine, State Navy, lacked aircraft carriers and was short of destroyers and battleships. The so-called pocket battleships, a term coined by the British and American media for the Panzerschiffe armoured ships, were no match for a battleship, and while their diesel engines gave them considerable range, they were much better suited to commerce raiding rather than naval battles, and slower than a contemporary battleship or cruiser. In 1939 there were plans to develop a strong U-boat arm, but at the outbreak of war there were few ocean-going submarines actually in service. Overall, despite ambitious rearmament plans, in 1939 Germany was short of manpower for its armed forces and heavy industry, and too short of fuel and raw materials to build the armed forces that had been planned. It was just that the early opponents were much weaker in manpower terms and equipment. The delay of almost a year after the Munich Agreement and the outbreak of war had been put to good use by the British, while the French response had been hampered by nationalisation of the aircraft industry. The problem for the British was that they were already running out of money. It has been said that in 1939 Britain could only afford a short war, but could only expect to win a long one. Nevertheless, Germany was also, in all practical terms, bankrupt by this time, with armament plans that could not be afforded. Germany strikes north. Denmark was one of the countries that placed their faith in neutrality in the years after Hitler came to power. Neutral since 1815, the country had lost Schleswig and Holstein in 1864, and from this time increasingly fell under the influence of Germany, a process that accelerated after Hitler's rise to power in 1933. That Denmark was within what might be described as Germany's sphere of influence was widely recognized, not only by her neighbors, Norway and Sweden, but also by her main trading partner, the United Kingdom. Alone amongst the three Scandinavian countries, in spring 1939, Denmark accepted Germany's offer of a non-aggression pact. Despite this, on the outbreak of war, there was no attempt to interfere with Danish trading links, and up to the invasion in 1940, the country continued to trade with the United Kingdom. A good indication of Denmark's agricultural importance was that after the invasion, the country provided Germany with 10% of German consumption of butter, eggs, and meat. Denmark was neutral in the fullest sense. Pacifist policies were widely advocated, and the armed forces did not have the same public and political support as in other European countries. It was not until 1937 that new legislation led to modernization of the armed forces. Despite this, in April 1940, the army had just 14,000 men, out of a population of 3.85 million, of whom no less than 8,000 had been conscripted during the previous 2 months. The small navy depended mainly on coastal defences to protect Danish waters. It had only 2 coastal defence vessels, one of which dated from 1906, 15 torpedo boats, of which 5 dated from before 1920, and 8 small submarines with 4,000 men. Between them, these 2 services had just 50 aircraft, mainly obsolete. While details of the planned German invasion were leaked to the Danish military attaché in Berlin as early as 4 April 1940, the reports were not believed initially. The head of the Abwehr, the German military intelligence and counterintelligence organization, Admiral Canaris, had released some details intending to embarrass Hitler, against whom he had considered a coup d'état in 1938. It was not until 8 April that any attempt was made to strengthen Danish forces near the border with Germany. The next day, at 04:15, German forces crossed the border against brief resistance from the army, while the navy, which had not been placed on alert, did not fire a single shot, and a German troopship entered the harbour at Copenhagen unchallenged. At 0500, German paratroops attacked the unarmed fortress of Masnou, south of Zealand, and an hour later Copenhagen was occupied. At this point the Danish government declared a ceasefire, and under protest accepted that Germany had occupied the country. Even so, the Danish government continued to maintain that the country was neutral until as late as 29 August 1943. Apart from its agricultural output, Denmark was important to the Germans as a stepping stone on their way to Norway, Operation Visserabung, and once that was achieved, as a secure means of communication with Norway. With both countries occupied, Germany also controlled the sea approaches to the Baltic, the Skagerrak and Kattegat. Norway was also intent on neutrality, as in the First World War, but was to prove a more difficult proposition altogether. Experience had shown that combining neutrality with being one of the world's major merchant shipping nations was difficult, but it had worked. In union with neighbouring Sweden until 1905, Norway had become almost completely demilitarized after the First World War. Rearmament did not really begin until 1937, so that by 1939 Norway had a poorly trained conscript army, an air force with few modern aircraft, and a small navy with few modern ships. Conscription had been introduced, but at first this was just 44 days, and even as war approached, was only increased to 84 days. The Royal Norwegian Navy had 2 battleships, although very small, with a ship's company of 270 men each, and an armament no larger than 8.2-inch guns, effectively the nominal armament of a heavy cruiser, and both dated from 1901. While another 2 ships granted the same outdated classification dated from 1898. Not surprisingly, all 4 had been reclassified as coast defence ships. 6 destroyers, of which 3 dated from 1936 to 7 and the other 3 from 1910 to 13, were of First World War size, displacing just 550 tons each. There were also 22 small torpedo boats and 9 small submarines. Despite the official policy of neutrality, much reliance was placed on automatic protection by British sea power. Despite this, there were Norwegian protests when a British destroyer, HMS Cossack, intercepted and boarded the German supply ship Altmark to release British merchant seamen taken prisoner after the German Panzerschiff Graf Spee had sunk their ships. Earlier, the United Kingdom and France had considered invading Norway during the Russo-Finnish War, also known as the Winter War of 1939-40, largely to make it easier to support Finland. Germany invaded Norway on 9 April 1940. There were two reasons for the invasion. Clearly, control of both Denmark and Norway ensured that the approaches to the Baltic remained under German control. But there was also the need to protect the vital supplies of iron ore from Sweden. As the Gulf of Bothnia froze in winter, the only all-year route for the ore from Sweden to Germany was via a Norwegian port, after a railway journey from Sweden. The fact that Norwegian airfields and ports provided the ideal bases with which to harass the Arctic convoys from Scotland and Iceland to Murmansk and Archangel was only to become a factor after the invasion of the Soviet Union in 1941. The Anglo-French plan to invade Norway would have centred on the port of Narvik, which might have aided Finland, but more probably would have denied Germany easy access to Swedish iron ore. And no doubt this strategic material would have been of value to the two Allied nations. The day before the German invasion, the Anglo-French Supreme War Council had ordered British warships to start laying mines in Norwegian waters to force German iron ore convoys into the open sea, where they would be attacked by British and French naval forces. Minor British warships were also deployed in case of any German action against Norway. It was around this time that the British Admiralty realized that the Germans had plans to invade Norway. The Norwegian Campaign. Norway was a more difficult proposition for the Germans than Denmark or even Poland. There was no land border, while the terrain was very difficult, with high mountains and the coastline heavily indented by numerous fjords. In April, much of the country was still covered by snow. Another factor was that the Norwegians had time to mobilize, with the king and the government escaping from Oslo, and there was time to ask the United Kingdom and France for assistance. The problems of geography had been taken into account by the German military planners. With typical German thoroughness, troops were landed from the sea more or less simultaneously at Oslo, Kristiansand, Bergen, Trondheim, and Narvik, and air-landed at Oslo and Stavanger. As with most military operations, all did not go according to the plan. The main initial setback was the sinking by shore-based artillery of the troop transport Blücher, which was carrying the main headquarters staff. The two allies were supportive of Norway's request for help, and despite their armies sitting in France, expecting a German attack at any time, the decision was made to send an expeditionary force to Norway. It was estimated that at least 50,000 troops would be needed to liberate the country, but little over half that number, an initial 13,000 British and Free Polish troops and 12,500 French troops, were dispatched quickly with air and naval forces. For the Allies, further problems arose. Good airfields were scarce in Norway because of the terrain, while the country was out of range of aircraft operating from bases in most of the United Kingdom, and nowhere within France was within range. Aircraft carriers initially had to be used as aircraft transports, rather than as the mobile airfields which they were supposed to be, with RAF aircraft then flying from frozen lakes. In any case, neither the Royal Navy nor the Marine Nationale had high-performance aircraft that could match a Luftwaffe Messerschmitt Bf 109. Despite these shortcomings, at first all went well at sea. On 10 April, shore-based naval aircraft from HMS Sparrowhawk, the Royal Naval Air Station at Hatsen on the mainland of Orkney, sank the light cruiser Königsberg, anchored at Bergen. This was the first sinking of a substantial operational warship by aircraft. That same day, what became known as the First Battle of Narvik saw two German destroyers and several merchantmen sunk at the cost of two British destroyers. But on 13 April, in the Second Battle of Narvik, nine destroyers and the battleship HMS Warspite sank the remaining eight German destroyers, a type of warship of which the Kriegsmarine did not have sufficient numbers. The initial British and Free Polish landings were near Narvik on 12 April. Narvik was chosen as it was seen as being easier to take and to hold than Trondheim, but it was recognized that Trondheim's capture was essential if Norway was to be liberated. Even so, Narvik was not captured, and the army commander of the force delayed taking the town, initially because he wanted to wait for the snow to melt, and then because he wanted the support of a half-brigade of French chasseurs alpins, not realizing that these were assigned to another operation. His last excuse was that he did not want to wound civilians by using naval gunfire to suppress the German defences, which were, of course, being strengthened during the delay. Further British troops were landed at Namsos, 100 miles north of Trondheim, and at Undalsnes, south of Trondheim. The northern force was expected to move south and capture Trondheim, but had to contend with 4 feet of snow and lacked air cover. Those at Undalsnes had to face repeated German attacks from the south, while being expected to cut railway lines and then move north. Having returned to his First World War post as First Lord of the Admiralty, the Royal Navy's political head, Winston Churchill, favoured an amphibious assault on Trondheim, but was dissuaded by the chiefs of staff on the grounds that this would risk too many troops and also place major units of the Royal Navy at risk. Plans for a land-based pincer movement were examined and found to pose as many risks as the amphibious assault. This left British and French troops fighting their way towards Trondheim. One British brigade managed to get halfway to Trondheim before being forced back north to Namsos, and only survived by being evacuated by the Royal Navy during the night of 3-4 May. There was a similar outcome for a combined British and Norwegian force, as they advanced from Undalsnes towards Lillehammer before being forced back. In short, the entire Norwegian campaign was cursed by complacency, and one senior officer maintained that if the Allies found withdrawal difficult, the Germans would also be unable to advance. But they did. Fate also played a part. When a new commander was appointed for the southern British forces, he fell ill and had to be replaced. His successor was flown in by the RAF, but when the aircraft landed en route at Kirkwall in Orkney, it crashed, killing 2 crew members and seriously injuring the other occupants. Within days of the invasion, the Luftwaffe had gained aerial superiority. Namsos and Undalsnes were both subjected to heavy bombing. Having transported aircraft to Norway, 2 aircraft carriers attempted to provide air cover, but as mentioned already, at this stage of the war, the fleet air arm lacked high-performance fighters. The RAF was little better, and although Hawker Hurricanes later arrived, for most of the duration of the campaign, obsolescent Gloster Gladiator biplanes provided the mainstay of the fighter defences, operating from a frozen lake at Lesjehagen, 40 miles from Undalsnes. The Hurricanes, when they arrived, were better, but still outclassed by the Messerschmitt Bf 109s. Eventually, on 24 April, Narvik was shelled continuously by the battleship HMS Warspite and 3 cruisers, but the British troops surrounding the town still failed to press home and attack, even though by this time there were 20,000 of them, and the German garrison consisted of just 6,000 men. Although the Marine Nationale did not have the same successes as the Royal Navy, Admiral Derrien, aboard the light cruiser Montcalm, commanded a small force that included the light cruiser Émile Bertin and 3 auxiliary cruisers converted from merchantmen. Under heavy Luftwaffe attack, these ships provided a valuable convoy escort service. The 2 Allied navies worked well together, prompting the French naval historians Orphin and Mordal to write, "Never in history had the..."
Sample complete. Ready to continue?